Nice shorts. Yeah.
Howdy, hey, and welcome to Nice Shorts.
I'm Fu Yang.
And I'm Johnny Niddle.
And this is a show where we interview animators about the shorts they make.
Today, we have Zaldi.
Zaldi is independent stop-motion animator,
filmmaker,
fabricator,
and just professionally curious tinkerer, hailing from the San Francisco Bay Area.
He started in online advertising back in the 90s, making websites and splash pages.
But he decided he hated making that much money, so he switched to animation instead.
Since then, Zaldi has taken a deep dive into stop-motion.
Recently finishing up work with Stupid Buddy in Burbank, California, animating moving Lego for season 2 of Lego Master.
Zaldi shares some stories and sneak peeks into his upcoming short film,
and talks a lot about how he gets from idea to finished animation.
So join us as we learn about Zaldi's 3D printers,
dance and sports influences,
and passion for joints!
Armature joints, that is, the ones legal in all 50 states.
And now on with the show!
I'm curious that, because you know 3D, you can draw and you do fabrication, you animate in stop motion. So what do you want people to know about you when you first introduce yourself?
I like to categorize myself as a curious tinkerer. You know, if something piques my curiosity, I want to poke at it more.
I just like the idea of just poking everything you like.
Right. Well, that's kind of how I approach a lot of things. So when I started college the first time around, years, decades ago, I originally started out as a computer science major. Because I wanted to major in art, but it was like, well, how are you going to make money in art? And then I majored in computer science. I did so poorly that I was almost put on academic probation. I changed my major to a couple of other things before landing into art. And when I landed back as an art major, this is the mid-90s, that's when the that first dot-com boom happened, and a lot of companies were looking for everybody and anybody that could use Photoshop, basically. If you knew how to use Photoshop and Illustrator, you could basically land yourself a job helping produce websites. And that's how I got my first job, was after I graduated, I knew how to use Photoshop and Illustrator. And it was like, oh, you can help us make websites and make buttons look pretty. And I was like, yeah, I can do that. Just sort of fell into it by accident. Animation is sort of a second career for me. I spent the better part of almost 15 years in online advertising and online media, working for a big tech company.
Exciting field.
Yeah. At the time, a lot of interesting things happening in online advertising and user information. That was fun. So I got laid off from my big cushy corporate job, and I decided, well, that job was sort of sucking my soul anyway. So instead of jumping back into, you know, another tech company, my wife and I had a little talk and said, hey, I want to pursue this animation thing, because I've always wanted to do it. And here I am. I studied 3D animation, fell into stop motion on accident, because one of the required courses was sort of this intro to animation class. And some of the projects involved stop motion animation. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the stop motion stuff. Mm-hmm. I pursued with the 3D animation because there's a lot more opportunities for it in the Bay Area, and with all the gaming and app companies here. But I really like to do stop motion because I like to work with my hands. I like to tinker with things. And it's just, the problem solving is a lot funner than sitting in front of a computer trying to debug software. You're more like you're debugging real life with stop motion versus trying to debug a computer. You know what I mean? It's just two different worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I fell into it.
It's like tangible problem solving.
Exactly.
Did you take anything out? I'm just curious, like, you must have learned a lot doing online advertising. Any of that come into stop motion?
Yeah, I actually did quite a bit of animating in online advertising. One of the big things, so the big company I worked for was Yahoo. I started there in 2004, back when they were
Huge.
A big deal. Back when they were a big deal.
When they had a shot.
Yeah, not such a big deal anymore, but back when they were a big deal, one of the works that I was really, or projects that I was really most proud of when I was at Yahoo was I actually got the opportunity to animate the Yahoo logo. So, not as popular as the, Google logos and Google animations at the time, which they still do, which are incredible. But I animated for the better part of like 4 years. I animated Yahoo's logo, in accordance to like, if it was like Chinese New Year, I'd do a Chinese New Year themed animation. Back to school, Father's Day, Mother's Day, the holiday ones, the Halloween ones. I animated a bunch of zombies in the in front of the logo, doing the Michael Jackson's Thriller dance, which is great.
And your love with dancing begins.
Yeah, that's where I figured out that I liked animating dances, was that because it was such a challenging
Wow.
project. I mean, it didn't get a whole lot of visibility because people tend to ignore logos on a website, and especially since, the logo's only like that big.
So far.
And there's this thing when you look at a website, you develop certain blindnesses to certain areas of a website. That's why when you go to a website, content people move the advertisement around, because after a certain amount of time, you stop paying attention to certain regions of a website because that's usually where the advertising is. And so you develop this like regional blindness, so your eye would automatically avoid that and go someplace else. So what we would do and is move our ads around so that, it sort of disrupts or disrupts where the positioning is, so the up the likelihood of a viewer seeing the ad and interacting with it. But because of that, people have sort of they knew it was there, but very little people interacted with it or viewed it.
That's, I gotta try that trick with like all the spinach I put in my fridge and then just let it die. I just move it around. I remember to eat it. So is that really where the animated dancing love started? Was the Thriller one?
That was one of them. I think I did an early logo, and it's actually on my website. It was a holiday logo of a gingerbread man doing a little dance, and that's where I started animating dances. So after that, I animated a few more logos with some dancing content. And yeah, I just liked, I think it's because I have, a background, a little bit of a background in music. And it's funny, when I animate things in a beat. You know what I mean? When I animate, even if I'm animating a walk cycle, I imagine what the beat would be of the walk cycle or of the movement. Or there's like this soundtrack that I sort of put over it, or planning a movement. I'm wondering what would this movement sound like if it was music. I see movement in music notes and rhythm. So I like, a standard walk cycle is like is a bunch of quarter notes. You want to add a skip in there, then add a couple of eighth note runs, little tippy toes, 16th notes. You know what I mean? I break down animation like I break down music. So I think that's why I fell in love with dances, because dances are very, they're challenging, but they're also easy to some degree, because you could break them down into musical measures, and then which enables me to break it down easier on an animation timeline, because then you could sort of predict, or you have a predictability or consistency on where your movements land, or where the critical poses of your character land.
Kind of harks back to the old like Betty Boop and Mickey Mouse stuff too. I know some editors that will edit instead of using temp music because you get stuck in your head. I know editors that will use a click track, just the metronome. and they'll edit to that. Do you ever go that intense with it when you're thinking up of the walk cycle?
No, but there's always a metronome in my head. You know what I mean? There's like a standard walk cycle. I have a certain metronome. It's basically it's almost like 60 beats per minute. Yeah, it's a pretty standard like beat when I do anything standard. So that's sort of how I break things down. I don't have a metronome on me. Well, I
Oh,
do have a metronome on
I
me.
got one right here.
Yeah. I have one on my phone, but I don't and I have a mechanical one somewhere. But
There you go. So much for that. That wasn't even 60, by the way. I don't have my glasses on, so we were way fast.
but I think it's, you know, now that I mention it, I think I might end up just trying that a bit more.
Music as well, right? But like most rhythms are some form of motion. Like I was talking to somebody the other day, and they're talking about odd meters, and I'm like 5/8 and 7/8 are actually very natural body motion meters. Like it's like it's a totally normal thing, or like a walk. It's like dun 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 dun. Or if you want, like you said, if you want to do a march, like dun 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 dun. So if you kind of, I mean, I don't know, like in your software how you would do that, but those rhythms are all naturally helping you know the rigidity and motion of a physical thing.
Yeah, and that's what I do when like when I animate something, especially in stop motion. It's funny when I do stop motion, I take a hybrid approach with a lot of the things that I do. I actually animate a lot of the things that I do in CG first.
Really?
Yeah, so I have a collection of just random, generic, lightweight animation rigs that I would bring into Maya, and then I wouldn't like polish the animation or anything like that, but I would at least animate the key poses and some of the breakdown poses, and then I would play it back just to see if it matches the rhythm in my head.
Oh.
So, and if it does, then I know that those are points in my stop motion animation that I need to hit. So, I mean, I would animate it with at the same frames per second. So I would take notes. Or sometimes I would export it as like a MP4 or whatever with the frame count so that I know what critical frames that I need to hit in my stop motion
That's really cool.
shot.
Is that kind of like doing a CG version of what do you stop motion folks call it? Like a breakout or where you
Pop
do like
through?
this like pop through. There you go. That was
Yeah.
way off.
No. But also like 2D, like a rough test, you just try to make sure the timing, the feeling gets right.
Yeah.
You got Stupid Body collaboration. How's the journey? Like you need to move there to LA, right? Can you share like,
Yeah.
yeah, the preparing like those to the audience and what you learn?
Well, first of all, I could talk about how I got the gig at Stupid Buddy. And that was pretty easy. I opened up my email one day and said, and this email from the animation recruiter at Stupid Buddy was like, "Hey, we saw your stuff. We like your stuff. You want to animate for us?" I was like,
Oh, wow. They found you. They asked you.
"Yeah, they found me." And I was like, "Okay, is this for real? Is this a scam? Is this a prank?" And they were like, "Yeah, we want you." And I was like, "Okay." So I said yes because they said it's a 2 month contract. We want you to come in and animate for these shows.
Did you test for it?
No.
Okay. Nice.
I didn't even talk to anybody until my first day there. Not even a phone call. It was all done through email. That's why I was a little skeptical at first because I was like, okay, yeah, okay, sure. This is an opportunity, whatever. Wink, wink. This is some sort of
You're like
scam.
looking at the email address, you're like, make sure it's spelled right.
Right,
Yeah.
exactly. And I even went on LinkedIn and looked up the person on
People,
LinkedIn to
okay.
see if they're an actual person. I was like, they're an actual person, and that's their actual email address. So let's see where this goes. So I said yes, and then they were like, okay, well, here's the details. It's going to be from, you know, this date to that date. You're going to be working on these projects, and here's a link to all the paperwork. I was like, ooh, suspicious, linked to paperwork.
Social security number.
Yeah, exactly. And then I clicked, I was like, okay, what the hell? I clicked on it and it was like to a legit like HR site. And I was like, okay, let's fill this out, see where this goes. Everything, like basically every click was like, what's this site?
Like you're the Goonies going through like the underground stuff.
Right. But like research, doing a quick Google search to make sure that the site that I was on, that right. Where the forms are actually legit. And everything was legit. So,
okay.
So they were like, okay, you start on this date. We'll see you then. I was like, wow. Okay, I guess.
How surreal.
I guess I'm going to LA for 2 to 3 months. And so, yeah, I found a place to stay. A couple of things I would have done differently, but yeah, found a place to stay. Booked a hotel for a couple months. It was one of those extended stay hotels, which I do not recommend.
No, having grown up in Southern California, I can tell you what those were like.
Yeah, that was an experience.
When you say you would like to do differently, is there an example? Like how different?
Well, so knowing what I know now, the worst part of the experience was actually the hotel stay.
Okay.
But it's balancing the cost of how much they're paying you versus the cost of 2 to 3 month hotel stay.
Right.
Because a bunch of the cost of that experience was actually on the hotel stay. So that kind of sucked, but the experience was great. The thing that I would have done differently is I would have, if I had known that the opportunity was very legit, I would have been able to book like a pretty inexpensive Airbnb like a month or two ahead. But because it happened so quickly and I didn't know if it was 100%, I had my doubts as to whether or not it was 100%.
Suspicious.
I waited until the last minute to book a hotel when I realized, oh my God, this thing is actually happening. So I booked pretty much one of the cheapest hotels that you could book without it being a complete dive. Mm-hmm. But that was really the worst part. Everything else was great. I mean, other than, you know, not being able to go everywhere because it was still at like at the height of COVID.
This year, March.
It was March of this year, March to June.
By the way, I got caught up completely current on Lego Masters, so I saw all the animation.
How do you animate multiple characters? How? Yeah, that's your first try, right? For how many, the maximum you had?
So that was the one scene. It was like the circus scene.
Mm-hmm.
There was one shot there, and it literally the shot only lasted like 2 or 3 seconds. Yeah, it was a little over 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I animated 24. There were 24 moving characters in that shot. Luckily, they weren't all like interacting with each other. They were all just sort of randomly moving.
Okay.
But because the schedule was so tight, you basically just went ahead and animated. You one take straight ahead, 24 characters. You're like, okay. So how I approached it was I looked at the scene. I was like, okay, so this person is the circus performers on stilts. So they're just going to be walking back and forth. There's going to be two people here that look like they're going to be talking, another person walking, another, you know, it's like there were like a handful of people just walking. but you basically just went and attacked it straight ahead. And what I had to do basically is in Dragon Frame, you have those little markers that you could put on screen. Mm. So I would like take these little markers and put them on to each character.
24 or a group?
No, I would put them onto each character.
Wow.
And then as I move the character, I would change the color of the marker. Just so I know that I moved that character.
Got it.
And to not touch him. It worked 90% of the time. There were a couple of times when I either forgot to move a character or couldn't remember which way the character was moving.
But we cannot tell, right? It happens so fast.
No, you can't tell.
Okay.
I could tell. I could tell, especially on the hip hop float. at one point I was moving like a dozen characters at a time. There were a couple of times where, you know, they're all doing sort of a rhythmic hip hop dance, as well as you could do in a with Legos. But it was a pretty rhythmic pose, like going like left to right or right to left. There were a couple of instances where I moved a character that was supposed to go left to right, and I moved them right to left, and so you would have this character like sort of jitter.
It's more real.
It happened so fast that only I could tell that it's missed.
It's more real. Not everyone can dance perfectly. Someone's got to be in Venice, like switching it up.
That's more real.
Yeah, but it was that. It was basically just problem solving on the fly. It was like, wow. How do I keep track of how I move all of these characters and just utilizing the tools that I had on me? And it was drag and frame and the markers and the ability to change colors. So I was like, okay, move that guy, change the color. Move that guy, change the color. At one point, I tried to get a little sophisticated and tried to use arrows, but that didn't work out very well. But
I imagine the leniency on that 24 characters with Lego. Well, luckily Lego, like you said, like you could be not smooth and it adds to it, which is cool. But
yeah,
I imagine the leniency because the eye is going to notice maybe two different things in 2 seconds.
There was a lot of leniency. The director that I worked with, he was all about just making it look as choppy as possible without it, you know, looking completely like an amateur did it.
Move like
a
toy.
Yeah, he really wanted to convey the toy, the toy that...
it guess it's appealing
to the feeling of the toy. Yeah.
You have like a precedent set from the Lego movie too. Like they did a great job of making it feel like that's how it had to move.
Yeah, but the Lego movie was different because they didn't actually animate Legos.
Right, it was all CG. But I mean, what I meant is like the movement of, so now like how a Lego character moves in real life is sort of established in people's brains already.
That's true. Yes. I know what you're getting at. The in the Lego movie, they had to mimic that style in CG.
Right.
Yeah. If they did it any other way in CG, it wouldn't have read.
No.
As Lego.
If the knee bent, it would have been pandemonium in the theater.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, burn it all down. No bent.
Right. Exactly. So when I worked at Stupid Buddy, they don't allow you to use other outside pieces of software. All they have is Dragon Frame. So the challenge was, okay, how do I animate these characters in a process that I'm not familiar with? Because I don't have access to my own software to do sort of the rough and then go back in and polish it in stop motion. So I had to do it the traditional way with doing pop-throughs. Mm-hmm. Actually, at one point, I had my iPad with me, so I would actually just do some roughs in Procreate,
mm-hmm.
Just some animation roughs in Procreate, and do my timing in Procreate, so that I could have some sort of timing reference that I could use before I jump into the stop motion stuff. So I still took a hybrid. I eventually took a hybrid approach, but it wasn't entirely kosher. But
but you had to completely change your style when you went there.
I had to change my process, and over there it was really about speed and really about just getting it done. They mm-hmm. want you to get it done as quickly as possible, so there wasn't really a whole lot of time to do anything, any prep work. Actually, they basically gave you direction on a shot, and you just basically had to dive into the shot. There's like even in some of the acting stuff. I mean, I didn't work on a whole lot of acting things, but on the few that I did, there wasn't even, you didn't really have a time to film a live acting reference and then analyze the reference and then, you know, do all your breakdown or anything. You just sort of had to dive in and go for it.
Wow. But like for what they need about that performance, it is okay, right? Like it's different direction, different purpose.
Yeah, what they relied more on, like especially if you've watched any Robot Chicken or any of their other works, is they rely heavily on pantomime, and so they have like basically pretty key movements that they often repeat you know, from character to character. So you could reference out other characters for certain acting cues or anything like that. So it's a process made for just churning out content than it is for, like, you know, making a feature film with dramatic acting or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Man, that sounds kind of intense. I'm saying kind of loosely there. That sounds intense. Yeah.
It was pretty intimidating the first day there. It was like, okay, here's your shot. Go animate. And you're like, what tools do I have? Oh, this is the only tool that I have. Okay. When do you need it done? By the end of the day? Okay.
So your style in general is make your own armatures or create your very unique way of using those armatures as well. And then doing extremely large, fluid, and emphatic body motions with it. Their style is very opposite of all of that. So that's just such a different approach. I can't imagine the whole dichotomy there.
It is, but there's a lot of things that I took from there that I'm going to incorporate with some of my processes, especially being more comfortable with sort of their straight ahead style of animation. Just gave me more confidence on how I can animate my own characters and add some of the their animation style relies heavily on exaggeration, like heavily. And my style, at least up until now, had some of that, but not to the extreme that they do. So I'm thinking about, or I'm going to, or my intention is to take some of the lessons that I've learned in terms of applying exaggeration to my characters and applying it to the, you know, to the projects that I'm working on. Because there's, if you think about it, there's not a whole lot of ways that you could get, like, when I worked on Lego Masters, there's not a whole lot of ways you could get a Lego guy to sort of emote emotion. So you had to rely heavily on pantomime, and then on or what little pantomime you could get with their very limited arm motions, but a lot with exaggeration. Just to get it to read on camera.
Yeah, it feels more like a theater performance, right? You need to let the audience far away to see what you are actually doing. So maybe that's kind of what they are aiming for, like be clear and exaggeration.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things that I did also is, like, when I would play it back, I would stand, like, I don't know, 6 to 10 feet away or as far away as I can, because some of the sets were really tight. But, you know, stand as far away as I can from the monitor, and then play it back to see if it's still red, you know, from a distance. Because if it still reads at a distance, then it'll read even better up close.
Right.
It's kind of like Johnny, that tip that you posted the other night about turning the volume down when you, it's sort of in the same vein.
Right. Yeah. Like getting up close, everything's exaggerated and details.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never thought about that, the visual version. But yeah, it's like the old silent actors when they went from stage to film and film was new and they all just over-emoted everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why those silent movies are like so cheesy when they're like just over-dramatic. They go, ah.
They actually had, like, there used to be like specific actual pantomime motions people would do on theater stages. Mm-hmm. You watch the early films and they're doing these poses. You're like, what the what is that? I'm so sad. You're like, okay.
Right.
Yeah, cool. Does it push you further than, because you go from, like, I mean, you have highly articulated armatures you're making, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Robot Chicken started with them just taking, like, the toys they found. I mean, the articulations are none to an extent. Mm-hmm. So the pantomiming was necessary, and it kind of became their staple, which I super appreciate. It's fun as hell.
Yeah.
Like, that just completely pushes your technique. And then did you bring a lot of that back into the motion you're doing now or no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. I think knowing how much you could accomplish with so little is so valuable. It changes your mindset, too, because part of the reason why I really overcomplicate my my armatures Like the first armature that I built, the first ball and socket that I built for Merlin Jones, you know, the wizard short that I did, mm-hmm. was so overcomplicated. There were so many joints that I added that I never actually used. And I was like, why did I even spend time doing it, you know, doing it this way? But taking something like that back, you know, being able to accomplish so much with so little is so valuable, and it's a huge time saver too. Because mm-hmm. then when I'm building stuff, then I know that, you know, there's certain things that I don't need to add. Like on the armatures that I built for the project that I'm working on right now, mm-hmm. One of the things that I, on my previous armatures, I would add like one additional extra link on their spine because I thought I needed it. Mm-hmm. So then what you end up is with this armature with a really, really like floppy spine that was really hard to control. But at the time that I made it, it was like, well, I thought I needed it because of, you know, certain things that I thought I was going to use it for, certain range of motions. Turns out the things that I didn't really end up needing that extra joint. And it just sort of overcomplicated things and made my puppet just floppier. So on this one, I eliminated it. And I'm like, well, let's see what we could get away with.
Nice. You should put like a poster of like Willie Nelson for call it a Willie Nelson puppet. It's too many joints.
Yeah. May I ask, like, when you say the possibility to need the joints on the spine, what kind of motion is usually will be very useful if you have that?
I think just like, especially when you're looking at the silhouette of a character and you mm-hmm. have them sort of bend over, part of it's just some of my experiences in CG. Like when you bend a character over, the CG characters have this really nice rounded spine. Part of it was just trying to mimic that in stop motion, trying to get that that sort of rounded spine look. But it turns out there's just ways to fake it in stop motion that doesn't really necessitate adding complexities to your armature. Like, if you wanted, especially if your puppet's wearing like clothing and you really wanted that rounded spine, but you don't have that extra joint to sort of make it happen, you could always like stick some cotton balls or something underneath his jacket or shirt or something like that. And usually that shot or that pose is only there for 2-3 frames. So it's like, why am I going through all this trouble to go through like 2-3 frames when I could just sort of fake it for 2 or 3 frames and then move on with my life.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
So you're imagining like these like ballet dancers then when you're building it, of like doing like the smooth bend over to touch the toes?
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds like it would be very difficult.
Yes.
Yeah. To build an armature that can do everything that I want it to do that's in my head would be just something that's so way overcomplicated that it wouldn't be practical. And like I said, a lot of it you could fake, so it's not a big deal.
Everyone should just hire you to make armatures for them, because I love how much thought you put into all of it. So this probably won't come out for a while. I don't know, do you want to talk about the thing you're working on? Or
yeah, we could talk about it.
How specific? I'm gonna let you say whatever you want to say, and I'm gonna sit here and just smile.
I like animating things that I physically can't do or physically can't do well. Like, I could dance a little bit, but I can't dance well. So that's why I like animating dances. I could play basketball. I can't play basketball well. I lack the vertical height. I lack the dribbling dexterity. I can't shoot worth a darn, but I could fake it. Those are the things that I like to animate. And that's sort of my purpose for animating, is sort of living vicariously through a puppet. So my next project is a basketball project. It's going to be two characters playing basketball, just to sort of push the limits of what I could do with two characters. Because from this point, my personal works have all been single character works. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've I've done multiple characters at my work at Stupid Buddy, but they were with, you know, Lego figures or little play school looking dolls.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sort of see how well or push the limits on animating more than one character, and not just animating more than one character, but animating two characters that are interacting with each other. Mm. I thought about doing a dance, but I was like, I'm a little burnt out on dances. Mm. And plus they could be really, really complex. I might do one of these days with two dancers. Anyway, I'm digressing. So it's going to be a basketball. It's going to be a basketball themed animation with two puppets playing basketball, but not necessarily in the, you know, NBA style or in the I'm going to run up and dunk it, you know, in the hoop or anything like that. I'm going to attempt to animate street ball style animation in puppet form, and we'll see what we can get.
Yeah.
Are you pulling up a bunch of the And1 videos for reference, or how are you choreographing this?
Right now I have it choreographed in storyboard and in my head, and lots of YouTube references. I started following a whole lot of streetball social media posts. If you're familiar with any of the players from the And1 tour, there's the professor, this white dude from Oregon he's got some crazy handles. He could dribble a ball like nobody's business, and uh-huh. An old school one. Another player from Atlanta, Hot Sauce, I follow him. Yeah, really, really great references. Some of the movements are so complex, and I'm building my puppet, and I'm resisting the urge to overcomplicate my puppet because of the complexities of the movement, and, you know, second guessing my puppet basically every time I look at it. Once I get the armature pretty much straightened out, which is actually fairly soon, then I'll start animating it in CG just to see how I could attack it with the limitations of my armatures.
It looked cool just with the shoes on.
Actually, here's the puppet right now. So now he has hands.
Oh, he
that'll
got
help
hands.
For dribbling. Nice.
And his hands are magnets. There's magnets in his hands.
Oh yeah.
So when I make the basketball is going to have like a couple of areas on it with basically a metal stud that'll help him grip it.
That's so cool.
His shoes, 3D designed or 3D modeled and 3D printed. The bottom of the shoes were hollow, so I shoved the armature in and packed it in with some polymer clay. And then this is what I'm going to make the mold out of to mold his, to create basically the flexible. Silicone. I'm thinking of silicone, but I'm also considering doing flex foam, which I've never worked with, but I'm thinking about using flex foam because if I make this out of silicone, it makes it hard to paint.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because, well, you need to use special silicone paint.
Huh,
And they're not the most forgiving. So I'm thinking of using flex foam just because you could use like acrylic paint or fabric paint on flex foam, and which, you know, through my research is what they say. I've never tried it. I think that's the thing with a lot of the things that I do too, is I do things that I've never done before. So I've never worked with flex foam. So we'll see how this goes. A lot of the projects that I attempt, it's like, well, I don't know how to do that. We'll try it anyway and see how it goes. Yeah, and so this is a puppet with his
shoes. Yeah.
With the shoes and magnets under the feet.
Yeah. I was gonna talk to you about that. So now you're adding more magnets to the hands. So you're replacing the rigging as much as possible with the magnets in the feet, and now the hands and the ball. Which is awesome. I'm just curious about maintaining the movement when suddenly you attach the extra weight for the ball, or I mean, are these things you're playing with already?
I'm experimenting with it. I think for a majority of the animation, the puppet's going to be attached to a rig anyway.
Hmm.
Just because the movements, there's a lot of, not really a lot of big jumping, but there's a lot of areas in the movement where both of his feet will leave the ground.
Okay.
Like, you know, especially when you play basketball and you're just guarding somebody and you're shuffling sideways, there's points where both of your feet will leave the ground. So he's going to be attached to a rig, I'd say about half the time, because he's going to be up in the air. Or both of the characters are actually, again, yeah, both of the characters are going to be attached to rigs. Well, that's going to be fun.
I wish I can dig into your brain right now, like to see all the pictures you are having.
There's a realization, it's like knowing that I have to use these rigs to keep them suspended, and then there's this realization that I have to use these rigs to keep them suspended. It's like knowing that I have to do it, yeah, I know I have to do it, and then suddenly realizing and going, oh, how am I going to do that? I'll figure it out.
Like, I'm curious, because I just, my brain does the thoughts of like, if it's a magnet that'll hold the puppet, one, will it hold it when one foot only is down? But second, if it's that strong, how will you get a foot like a couple millimeters off the ground without it wanting to clamp back down? Like, are you going to do shims under it to keep it separated from the ground, or?
Yeah, I'm going to have to use shims, okay. Especially if it's like little teeny tiny tippy toe steps where his feet are probably going to be, I don't know, 2, maybe 3 millimeters off the ground.
Right.
I'm going to have to use a shim and then edit it in post.
And then just add in the shadow back.
Yeah. But I would rather do that than try to edit out literally hundreds of holes on the stage. Because that would be the other alternative to magnets, is just literally hundreds of holes on stage.
Back to like about a silicone and a flexible foam. From your research about the safety, anything you compare both of that? The process, are they similar or?
They're very similar. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I haven't studied the safety. Good.
Yeah, better.
I do take precautions. I wear a mask and I wear gloves, you know, COVID. and I do, I always do it in a well ventilated area. I do everything in my garage, and usually when I work with, especially with 3D printing, I use a resin printer. And that gives off a really, really awful smell.
Yeah.
And if you're around it too much, it could give you a raging headache. So I use my 3D printers in a well-ventilated area. You know, I crack the garage door open. I open the back door in the garage just to get some airflow in. I have some fans going off when I'm running my 3D printer too. So it's the same process when I use silicone. And I imagine it's the same process. It's going to be the same process with using foam.
Okay.
Because, yeah, the last thing I want is to have my kids or my wife find me, like, collapsed on the floor.
R.I.P. Zaldi. But he made some great shoes.
That's too much sacrifice. But I got 2 points. Like, you are creating something you never tried before. Like, that's a lot of courage. So I want to know that. Can you tell us more about how do you do the research and what kind of mindset to embrace? If it doesn't work, just try another. Like, how do you deal with it for the new things you try?
Oh, I deal with it in several ways. well, the first thing that comes up is the idea, which is, I think, the hardest part. The hardest part to anything creative is the idea, because you're trying to create something out of thin air. After that, the idea comes up and I finally, you know, sit down and figure the idea out. I either write it down as a short synopsis of what the idea is, or do thumbnails or storyboard it. then I just try to figure out what the logistics is. So I just sort of dive into the logistics part, which I think is one of the main parts that I enjoy the most, is the logistics part, is the problem solving part. Mm-hmm. So I just dive into it and see what I can do and sort of noodle over how I can accomplish it. It's a lot of trial and error. It's a lot of experimentation. I'll experiment with like old armatures that I built, mm-hmm. and just to see if, you know, there's anything I could use from it. Any design wise, anything I could use from it, or what I can improve on it. Things that I could take away, things that I could add. Yeah. And a lot of it's just, especially with stop motion, is there's not really one way to do anything in stop motion. Yeah. You have to find several creative ways to accomplish things in stop motion, because nobody ever does it the same. Mm-hmm. So there's going through like other people's blogs, articles that people read, researching different items to see if I could use them for something that it's not intended for. Like one of the things that I, with regards to independent filmmaking, the biggest hurdle in independent filmmaking is cost. And so yeah. a lot of my problem solving is also related to cost. Like I know I need a bunch of rigging, but rigging is expensive. Like the professional, like winder riggings that you can buy. There's only like what, three or four companies that make them. Two of them are in London. One of them's in South Korea. I think there's another one in like South America somewhere, but they're all like a couple $100, like $250 or $300 for this little winder gear that you could attach your puppet to so that your puppet could move up and down. Mm. So I'm like, well, I could research how to build one myself, which I've done. Mm-hmm. Because I have a 3D printer. I was able to like print out some gears and make my own quick and dirty winder gear.
And that costs how much? After buying the equipment, after the printer.
It wasn't too bad. It was probably like $20.
That's rad.
Wow.
$20, and that was because the gear that I had to buy was like one of those straight gears. Or those bar gears that cost like $15, but the rest of it was like made out of like
printout pieces.
Well, the gears were printed out pieces. I had some screws that were just laying around, or went to the hardware store and buy some cheap screws. Mm. And the two plates that basically connect everything together was an aluminum ruler that I bought. If you're familiar with a shop called Harbor Freight, they sell cheap
like single use stuff with a go replace.
But you could buy like a 4-foot aluminum ruler for like $4.
Oh wow!
So I bought a 4-foot aluminum ruler and I cut it to use as basically the attachment plates for this rigging. And that's because I went to the hardware store and I went to see how much I wanted to buy, like just a strip of aluminum. Well, a strip of like 2-foot aluminum is 2 feet by 2 inches. It was something insane, like $15-$20 for a 2-foot piece of aluminum. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound right. That's pretty expensive. So I went to Harbor Freight and I was like, oh, look, it's an aluminum ruler for $4 and there's 4 feet worth. I'll just take that and cut it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's that, and like, you know, problem solving with budget in mind. Mm. Another rigging thing that I'm going to experiment with, and I don't have it in this room with me, is I found a little on eBay, a little stand for like a digital microscope, and it was like $12. But it has like, so you attach like a digital microscope to it, and there's like a knob that you can move the microscope up and down.
Oh wow!
Well, I'm just gonna, and that's just the stand was just $12, so you just bought the stand, and I was like, well, I'm going to attach something to it, and now I have this like quick and dirty winder gear for $12.
Oh, a lot of problem solving again.
Yeah, a lot of problem solving. Yeah, just figuring out what the possibilities are with my ideas. There's a lot of sketching involved. A lot of problem solving sketches, just working out, just logistically working out how things will physically work in the real world, how to defy gravity.
The basketball short. Do you actually have it all blocked out and mapped? You know where the action is before you've even started doing anything? Or how strict are you approaching this?
This is going to be pretty strict, in my approach because I want to keep it to under a minute and a half, I'm
Still.
hoping. Because, I mean, anybody that's done stop motion or even traditional animation or anything like that, you know that a minute is a long time.
Yeah.
The shots that I animated at Stupid Buddy, each one of those shots were 2, 3, 4 seconds at most. And that was for a shot. You're animating literally like, I don't know, 36 to 48 frames at a time. But yeah, a minute's worth. Oh, it's not one giant shot, though, so it's broken down quite a bit. Hopefully into 3 to 4 second chunks, which would make it easier. I'm sorry, I'm like problem
No,
solving.
please. I would love if you start working out the entire thing right now, I'll just sit here and watch. I'm on board.
No, so when I started storyboarding it, so I had, like I said, I had the idea in mind. Then I visually knew what I wanted it to look like in my head, which is always a complicated thing to do because what it looks like in your head versus what it looks like in real life, totally different things. So that's why the first thing that I did was I wrote up like a quick synopsis of what it was, just literally 2 or 3 sentences. It's going to be two characters playing street basketball. Okay, cool. And then I dove into storyboarding it. Tiny thumbnails, because if I try to do big storyboards, then I try to make each panel into a work of art and its own one. And
Too
then
detailed,
I
no.
get derailed. Yeah, I get derailed. So yeah, I storyboarded it, and as I'm storyboarding it, I'm thinking about how I am going to mechanically or physically accomplish this. Like some of the shots when I was storyboarding it, I was like, okay, he's going to do this move, and he's going to dribble this way, and he's going to fake, and just all of that, and I storyboarded it, and it was like 12 panels of the same ex of basically the same exact angle, and I'm looking at that, and I'm going, well, the movement's great, but visually it's just pretty one-noted, and trying to animate that, it's going to be like a 15-20 second shot. And that's a lot to animate. So I need to break it down. So it was, yeah, approaching it that way. I did sort of a storyboard of all the shots sort of in their long form, and then I would take it back and cut it because, well, first of all, one camera shot over a length of time is pretty boring.
Too
So I would
still.
break it down just too still. Even if there's a lot of movement in the shot, if the camera doesn't change angle or do something, it just looks pretty static. So I would, yeah, then I would break the shot and break it down some more and break it down some more so that now I have a storyboard of all the shots sort of in their manageable chunks. It'll be another story when it comes to setting up the camera and lighting for each shot, but I'll cross that bridge when I get there.
And like an amateur comes a little later, right? You kind of know the picture or the purpose, so amateur is easier to design for that purpose, right?
Yeah, exactly. So after I storyboarded it, I had like with the storyboard, I had a loose idea of what the characters would look like. After storyboarding it, I jumped into, well, as I was storyboarding it, actually, I jumped into character design. So a lot of times when I'm storyboarding, I would have like some pages dedicated in my sketchbook for storyboarding, and I would actually flip to the back of my sketchbook and start drawing the characters. So, because I don't want to disturb sort of the flow of my storyboard with a character design somewhere in the middle, so I would
change out of space for that.
Thinking. Yeah, yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I designed my character as I was storyboarding, and that led to me having to tweak the storyboard quite a bit, because sometimes a character design changes what a shot looks like. So yeah, that's sort of my process with it.
Nice.
that's all?
Yeah. About the performance, how do you evaluate? How do you be really on point on what you want to say visually?
So as I was storyboarding, I started collecting references. And the references actually changed the storyboard quite a bit too, because there were certain moves that a player would make. And I was like, ooh, I want to add that in. I had to take away quite a bit because I was adding in way too many moves. And I was like, I don't have time to animate all of this. Again, I haven't taken it to the next step yet, but my next step to this would be, I would animate bits of the critical parts of the performances, the key poses of the performance in CG, just to have an idea of what it would look like animated. Because especially when you're animating things from a reference, like when I animate dances, it's always from a reference because I can't choreograph this stuff. I don't know how. If you animate it exactly as the reference looks, then it just looks rotoscoped. You know what I mean? If you've ever seen like animated characters that were obviously traced from like live action footage, or motion captured stuff has the same look too. It just, they look odd.
You're right. The real version already exists. Like if you're going to do this, do it for a reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's subtleties that you can't, that are impossible to capture. Even if you're doing something that's motion captured related onto a really, really sophisticated 3D character rig, there's just subtleties that you won't be able to capture through like motion capture. So, but I animate it in CG just to get an idea of what it would feel like. Usually it feels strange. So I would need to go back to the CG version and tweak it. That's where I'm going to employ a lot of the sort of the lessons in exaggeration that I learned at Stupid Buddy is apply it to that part of the performance. So when I animate stuff on references, try to figure out where I could add the exaggeration or where I could exaggerate it even more so that it gives it more of an animated feel. And not this weird rotoscoped feel. But what's funny is even after I animate it and get it sort of in its CG animated form, sometimes when you take that and you animate that in stop motion or you reference that in stop motion, your stop motion ends up looking weird also. Mm-hmm. So there's like this thing that I do where, I don't know, it's overkill to some people. To animate something like twice. But I would, when I do the stop motion part, there's a lot of things that I would add and a lot of things that I would take away in the stop motion performance just to make sure that it reads well or the performance reads well.
Such as?
Well, the first thing is gravity. Gravity is weird. When you rotoscope something or you motion capture something, when you play it back in CG, it looks floaty. It looks like the characters are weightless. So what you would have to do in the CG form is add more weight to the characters. And you do it by tweaking how much they're in the air or making like, if they're walking, making sure that their bounces aren't like this gliding bounce and more of a, trying to basically get them more attached to the ground and making their bounces more abrupt. But when you take that CG form and you animate it in stop motion, the same thing happens. It just looks a little floaty. So things like when I do dances, if you compare their feet from the live action version to the feet of the stop motion version, the feet on the stop motion version are on the ground a lot longer than they are in the actual choreographed version. Mm. The hips and the stop motion version are up in the air a lot less, or you know, maybe like 1 or 2 frames less than it would in the stop motion or in the live action version. And in fact, it's adding those bits of exaggeration that really get it to pop. And that's the thing, is to, you know, try to make the movements of your character pop more. Mm. Another thing that I would do is just amp up the anticipation of my characters too. Right. Cause like in a lot of the dances that I do, or that I've animated, I've added anticipation in areas that didn't exist in the reference. You could feel the anticipation in the reference, you just don't see it.
Yeah.
But in the animated version, you have to actually animate that anticipation. So it's adding stuff like that, and really exaggerating like the easing in and the easing out. And sometimes you just don't want it to ease into it to a movement, because sometimes like CG has this thing where it's like everything moves, like there's this nice cushion out and nice cushion in, but sometimes when I animate stuff or in stop motion, you want to sometimes make things stop more abruptly. Or on live action references, you rarely have somebody just sort of hit a pose and just stand there for like, or have that pose be like completely still for like 2 to 3 seconds, or not seconds, but 2 to 3 frames. You know what I mean? There's always like some sort of wiggle or some sort of wobble in something on their body. But when you animate it in stop motion, sometimes you want that, just that still pose for like 2 or 3 frames, just because the viewer needs to read that pose. And if you're not holding that pose, then it just doesn't read.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's adding those things. It's always adding, I use a reference, but I don't copy my reference.
Okay. Yeah, I love how you analyze this. And you are now analyzing how do you read if the reference is from others, like those people who are good at basketball, who are good at dancing.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm. You try to translate into animation. And I wonder, how about if you need to be the reference? You need to shoot yourself. How do you enhance the skill to perform in your story you want to tell?
Shooting my own reference is hard. I don't know what it is. I think it's like, you know, when you hear a recording of your voice played back to you and it just sounds funny. That's sort of the same thing as watching yourself.
The motion.
Watching yourself perform.
Okay.
It's jarring. It's weird.
Like, I thought I was decent at dancing.
Right. It's uncomfortable. Right? Like on a couple of the dance things, well, on every dance choreography that I did, there were a couple of points where I did film or try to film some of the dancers' movements just to get a better understanding of what they're actually doing with their feet and their hands. And I would film myself and I was like, okay, that felt pretty good. And then I would play it back. And I'm like, wow, I'm terrible. I look like I have 2 left feet. What's going on? But yeah, when it comes to that, I try to film. I do film my own references.
Yeah. How about dialogue? You do dialogue too. And yeah. That kind of performance.
That's hard. I mean, I do it, but it's really hard to critique your own work. I think the thing with me is knowing that I have limitations in my skills with regards to that. Like, I know what good acting is. Mm. I just don't know how to perform it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So when I, like, sometimes when I film a reference, I would film myself either doing or acting something, but then I would have to go back and like sketch basically my, or do like a little storyboard of my performance, because there's like certain things in the performance that I wanted to hit that I didn't hit. So I would have to like make a visual note of what that hit should be. Like I did that a lot with when I was working on the cookie cutter with Steve. Mm-hmm. Some of his facial reactions. Some of it I actually acted out. The videos no longer exist. but I would act it out, play it back, play myself back to myself, but then sketch out what the critical parts of his expressions would be, so that when I animated it, I made sure to hit those critical poses
for the emotion thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's sort of my approach with filming references is I film my references knowing I have limitations in my skills, but I would try to go back and either do a quick sketch. What I know some people have done is they would actually sketch over like their live action performance using, I don't know what software you would use, but I do something similar, except I play it back and I just sketch it out on paper.
That's a hard thing about anime. I was talking to a student and he said, because during COVID, everyone went back to their places and just did online. He's like, they had to do all their own reference videos. And you're talking about students who can't act and they're animators. And now they're all hamstrung by how good of an actor they are.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the only mediums where that's the case. Like it's, yeah, it's unfair. And I appreciate you all for trying.
Yeah, but after I hear what Zali is saying, I feel there's hope, right? Like, yeah, we all have limitations, but through the experience and through a lot of kind of like a rehearsal on the paper, just try to think through and you will find a better way visually in the animation form to make a performance stronger. Like, just do more path for it.
Well, what I actually helps also is having a sketchbook handy when you do your reference performance. Like with this basketball project that I'm doing, I haven't filmed myself doing any of the reference yet, but I plan on doing some of it. But I know that I can't dribble a basketball as well as a lot of these streetballers can. But I want to know what some of the critical components are of that movement. So I plan on taking a basketball in my backyard and just attempting some of the dribble moves. But having a sketchbook handy and attempting some of those movements, you could make the attempt and then you could quickly sketch while you can remember what you did, quickly sketch what you think you did. You know what I mean? Because what you think you did versus what you actually did are two different things. Because when you play back the reference, you're like, what the hell am I doing there? But when you're actually acting it out, you're like, well, I felt like I did this. I felt like I moved my hand here or my arm there. So that's what I'm going to sketch out. But yeah, when you play back the reference, you're like, but I didn't do any of that. But that's what it felt like.
Fu, you both mentioned, it's a good point. It's like most of the references you use are the best at what they do. Like the Russian stop motion animator who did the ballet, I think her name is Polina.
Or martial arts too.
Yeah, she did the staff one as well.
Yeah.
I mean, she made those look amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
like, if you're using a reference, like, let's say you're doing a ballet dance. You're using a reference of a person who is trained to make gravity look not real. And then you already have the problem of gravity doesn't look real. Reality doesn't look real if you see it running other than your eyes.
Right.
So, like, you're doubly making it difficult by using the best at what they do, where seeing them in real life is like, wait, that's not real. So how do you, I mean, do you have to dumb down the basketball people?
Not having animated this yet, I can't really accurately answer that. I'm just going off with what I've done with the dances that I've animated. And that is, yes, there are moves that you have to dumb down because they do not read well or at all when you animate them. Like, especially with hip hop dance, there's certain muscle twitches that happen that you can't replicate with an armatured character. So you have to dumb it down. You have to either eliminate it or exaggerate the movement before and after the movement to hide the fact that you eliminated this little thing.
You need more joints.
Muscle twitching joints.
like you know what I mean? Like one of the hardest things to to do with an animated character, either in CG or in stop motion, is to create muscle tension. Like you get an animator, you get a character's hand, and let's say they, you know, they just clench their fist like this. But then you do that with a puppet, and the puppet's made out of, like, let's say it's latex or foam, and you clench their hand, and you don't get the muscles that are popping or the tendons or anything like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Just you just sort of have to cheat it and close it and just sort of have to shake it like that. So some of those little cheats that you have to add into it, or sometimes you have to eliminate some of the movements altogether.
That's fascinating. I never thought about the hand close thing. And I was like, amazing. I guess you could add the face, or you can go in post and add like the because we get the colors, right? Like, well, I'm so pale that nothing changes, but you get like the color tension that happens on the knuckles and whatnot. So
yeah.
Do you add stuff like that too in post or no?
I haven't.
If you want
that
to.
That seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, it depends, right? Hold on.
It sounds like a lot of work, says the person creating a whole new way to try something they've never done, to do a stop motion for basketball. But
That's true. But my things that I haven't tried yet bucket is a little full right now. So to add one more thing might be taking it over the top. But yeah, like with I know for a fact that there's going to be certain things that I'm going to have to either really dumb down or really exaggerate in some of the things that I do. But hopefully that'll add to the charm of it being animated versus live action. Because I know that there's certain things that these players do that I will not be able to replicate. But hopefully I could do my best with sort of conveying that feeling.
Yeah.
In an animated character, or trying to figure out how to convey that feeling in an animated character.
But that's an interesting challenge, right? Because like, it's like the breakdancing you mentioned, part of breakdancing is to make things look like it can't be done real. Like when they are doing like full quick twitches, it's made to look like they're skipping frames. If you try to replicate that in stop motion, you're just skipping frames. So it's right. The opposite. So you want to make, you're taking something that's supposed to not look real in real life, and then you're supposed to take something that's not real life to make it look real. It's such a cool, your job is hard.
Sometimes they look a lot less impressive animated than they do in real life. And actually that's an interesting thing too with some of the dances that I've done. Like I follow a couple of dancers, like on YouTube and on Instagram, and mainly because I like dancing, or I like watching dancers. My daughter is also in a hip hop group, or my youngest daughter. So she does a lot of dances, and she's way better than I am.
Free reference videos.
Actually, she's done one for me.
Oh yeah.
So there's certain dance choreographies that I've avoided animating because I know that they just won't read well animated. There's so many things, so many subtle movements that the dancers do that I know I won't be able to replicate with a puppet. It's hard enough to do it. Even if you did it in CG with a really, really advanced character rig, it would be something hard to pull off. So yeah, there's certain things that I just avoid because I know that they won't look as impressive animated.
I imagine Hyphy would look amazing.
There's certain ones like crumping would look weird animated because there's just so much tension to it. And you can't replicate a lot of that tension.
Wow. So like aggressiveness kind of stuff. Like let's pretend you're doing the Hulk. You have to just sell it with, if you can't do the muscle twitches, you have to sell it all with just facial expressions then? Or shaking?
Yeah, facial expressions and shaking.
And that's all you guys.
Actually, they've done, I mean, wow. I've been like binge watching a lot of Robot Chicken.
Yeah.
Ever since my stupid buddy experience, they've animated the Hulk quite a bit in a lot of their skits. And yeah, to get that aggression, they use a whole lot of just facial expressions and twitching.
That's cool. It's like anger and being cold are basically the same thing.
For the most part, it's
Yeah.
just a change in expression and/or change in environment, pretty much.
Man,
Nice tip.
you've done so much stuff. So you're doing the basketball stuff. You're not doing holes, which is great. I'm guessing you're doing it on a basketball court, so you're going to replicate asphalt, but is this all in the garage?
Yes.
And it's just permanent setup, whether you got all your printers in there, you have great accessibility for breathing. That's fantastic. But like, so you have just one stage that you just have kind of that you just swap between whatever you're doing, and that's what you're going on right now.
Yeah, because I mean it's a two-car garage, which doesn't have any cars parked in it, because
It doesn't snow in California.
yeah, I'm basically taking up like half of the garage because the other half is filled with like, household supplies and cleaners
Tax write-off.
and what else? The washer and the dryer that are in the garage, and all of our bicycles are in the garage. So it's half of its storage, but the other half is basically my little workshop.
What's your lighting setup in there for that and your camera setup?
I have a couple of cameras. I have a really, really giant, heavy duty Hercules tripod, which was a great find on eBay that I bought for like
Amazing.
$250. It's a tripod that's meant to hold like old giant film cameras. This thing, the tripod alone weighs like 35 pounds,
Jeez.
which is great for stop motion because even if you accidentally bumped it,
You just hurt your toe.
There's basically three knobs. There's a knob to move it up and down, one to pan it, and one to sort of tilt it. So it's great. It's overkill for what I use it for, but I mainly have it because it's heavyweight, and if I accidentally bump into it, I don't have to like try to adjust my set or anything like that.
Do you close the garage and block out all lighting for when you're and set up your own for that, or?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I close the garage. I make sure that laundry isn't going because when you have the dryer going, then the power fluctuates in the garage and my lights flicker.
That's
So
a good
there's some
note.
logistical stuff. And also like if I'm animating in like late spring and on to summer, it gets super hot in there. So I tend to do a majority of my animating in the evenings and at night. Like I've had a couple of instances where, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning and my wife would pop in, like just she'll pop in. She's like, "You're still here animating?" I was like, "Yeah, I have to finish this shot. I'm on a roll."
Have you seen the weather forecast for tomorrow?
Exactly. It's 50 degrees in the garage. It's great.
Like,
It's not
oh
because
man.
usually when it gets really like the past week it's been super hot here, and literally like a couple days ago I have a little thermometer in the garage, and it was like 95 degrees inside the garage at like and it was like 11 o'clock in the morning. I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna last in here."
Garage is when it's like 95 to 100 outside. Garage is hit like 115.
Yeah.
Is there any materials that you've learned to like not work with on a set or anything that just don't work?
Clay. Clay is, which is funny because the characters that I'm using that I designed for my next upcoming short, they're originally designed as clay characters. But with as hot as it gets in my garage, clay becomes very, very, very problematic to work with when it's really, really hot. It basically just starts to melt. Like you touch it and it just sticks to your fingers, and it's hard to clean up. So I'm playing around with yet another thing that I haven't done with a puppet, but I'm making the puppets look like clay by making them out of polymer clay. So here's a test skull. So this is one of the characters. So I 3D printed his skull, and then I wrapped his skull with polymer clay, and then I baked it.
Oh, okay.
And basically, I was experimenting to see if I could actually bake polymer clay onto
The
a 3D
3D.
printed resin part without melting anything, and it worked.
Ah.
And so now I have, and it's two halves actually.
Wow.
So once I have it glued together, I'll fill this up over here with polymer clay just to hide the seam. And the final version is actually going to have eye sockets. This was mainly a test just to see if the polymer clay would stick to the 3D printed part, and it did. Now it looks like a clay character,
Clay character.
but without the disadvantages of it melting while I'm animating it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool. Did you bake it as a test, but then now think the baking also kind of shrink wraps it to the
Yeah.
frame? So like, that's so cool.
And it's going to be the same concept with the armature. So with the armature, like this part, the upper part of his leg and the lower part of his leg are going to be baked polymer clay.
Wrap it up.
Yeah, but whereas the middle of his leg, where the joint is, that's going to be unbaked polymer clay, just so I could bend it. And I did that just to maintain the look of a clay character, just to get it to bend like a clay character without having the disadvantage of working with a clay character. So that's some of the things that I'm experimenting with too, and hopefully I could pull it off.
Oh, that's so
Yeah,
cool.
it sounds very promising. I think it's a little similar to what we did with a snuggle time. It's also like a wrapping with, yeah, fresh one and baked one. But yeah, so far I met is that maybe it's because the clay I use is the beige one, that type, and that was very delicate even after baking it. So after a while, it's pretty easily. But maybe you have different color and your product is different. You will be stronger. I hope so.
Well, we'll see. It's going to be an experiment.
Yeah.
If I pull it off, then cool.
I have a probably very stupid question, but I imagine so you bake it, the moisture comes out, makes it stronger and better. Does it dry out to the point like where it might crack after a little while? Like, do you have to moisturize it?
No, because it's polymer clay is very resilient stuff. It's not like an earth clay. It's actually plastic.
Oh,
So
it's healthy.
and that was the experiment with this, was trying to see how what plastic would be like to bake on plastic. So it's very plasticky. It's pretty versatile too, because you can polish it, you can drill it, you can sand it. A lot of people use polymer clay for jewelry making, or for making, like, I've seen refrigerator magnets made out of. Actually, we have some refrigerator magnets made out of polymer clay that I've been kicking around for like 20 years, and
Wow.
you know,
Still
they're
there.
still like, yeah, they're still there. They're haven't cracked or worn or anything like that. So it's pretty resilient, but I love the look of it, because it looks like it's clay without it being clay. And I don't really have to worry about it cracking, because like I said, it lasts for a long time. It'll keep its integrity for a long time, much longer than the intended use of the animated short and any subsequent animated short that I'm going to be using these characters for. So it'll last for years.
That's so cool. So, are you going to do all the features in CG, or are you going to do them on it with clay?
Another thing that I took from Stupid Buddy is I'm going to be using stickers for mouths.
Okay, on the surface.
Stickers for mouths. I'll probably create like eyebrows with polymer clay and bake them, and just use some sticky wax to attach them to them. The eyes are going to be actual.
Like
Where am
bead?
I?
Googly eyes.
They're going to be just actual
Okay.
plastic nylon bearings. I still need to. I'm in the process right now of designing his final skull, or the skull armature, so that there's an actual eye socket to attach this to. And also another socket on the bottom to attach it to the actual armature. But that's a lot of the things that... That's the goal. It keeps me distracted, too. So every time I get bored with one part of the process, I have something else to work on. I don't know. I think I have, like, adult ADHD or something like that. I get distracted really easily. So projects like these are great because it's like, oh, I'm distracted, you know. I get distracted by things related to the short, so something always gets accomplished.
Yeah, you are still going towards the direction. Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a word for it. It's like a procrasta education or something like that. It's like I procrastinate by going like, well, I don't have to write this music, but what does that culture do? And like, you just like go into like some random music from like some little remote area and you're like, ah, it's kind of, yeah.
I totally do that. Mm. I'm going to use that then.
Procrastinate. I love it.
There's a word for it. Yeah. There's a tongue tie twister. You know what? I'm done talking. Hey, Fu.
No. I want to know the word.
I've done that with researching my short, like looking at like street basketball players, you know, street ball players. Then I started looking like the history of street ball and then like the history of the Ann Winter. And then next thing you know, you become like this pseudo subject matter expert on street ball.
Like smoking a pipe, wearing a robe, doing like your little documentaries, like the beginning of street ball.
Right. But I do believe that, it feels like procrastinating, but no, it's kind of, sometimes you find a real, like, authenticity, right? You know what's that for. It's not like you just copy something you see. You know what's that about. So, yeah, taking time to do those researches, it really gives a little different level. People will remember more about what you're making, I think. Yeah.
See, that's going to be my excuse now. I'm procrastinating so that my work will be more authentic.
Yeah, your work is always authentic.
You said you'd be willing to do like armatures for people. And I mean, like you kind of just enjoy constantly trying new ideas and changing things up. So what are the things you would like to be hired for?
Armature building would be nice. Fabrication. Mm. I love doing fabrication. Some of the most enjoyable time I had with working on the cookie cutter was actually making a lot of the props.
I love them.
It's funny with those props too, is because in each one of those props, I added something that I've never done before with a prop. Like, the fishing pole that I made, it was a working fishing pole for the most part with an actual working 3D. I 3D printed a little reel, a little fishing reel that actually
have the mechanic.
Works.
Please to every studio mail out another 3D printed version of it, go here's my reel, and just send out the actual little 3D printed reel.
It would be cool,
the best prop the demo ever.
And the bathtub that I made for the cookie cutter
bathroom scene.
Yeah, for the bathroom scene. That was fun because I designed that one in 3D. So I have one of those Cricut paper cutters. So I took the 3D model, I ran it through a piece of software that basically flattens it out into a 3D, into a paper pattern. I ran that through my paper cutter. I created basically a paper version of the bathtub. Mm. And then I took that paper version and I covered it in plaster. And that's how I created the bathtub. And then I 3D printed the claw feet of the bathtub. So that was a fun one because it was just noodling over how to make a bathtub. And
yeah,
in a
instead
way
of molding.
Yeah.
What's a Cricut print? I hear Cricut. I think of like Jiminy. I think India's really good at it. And then I think like they're loud.
It's basically a paper cutter. Okay. It's one of those automated paper cutters. You know, you could make like vinyl stickers and signs and whatever. Yeah, but I have one of those that I use for various stuff. Mostly for making like vinyl stickers for my daughters because they're like, hey, I want a sticker. But
I want stickers.
I'll make some. I'll I'll figure out a logo for this and make some stickers for him.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
For my next production.
Ooh.
Yeah. And you said your bucket was full.
Every personal project of what you make is so professionally done. Like, you really have a great set of what you want to approach, and you also grow and learn from it. So for the long run, you're thinking to have your studio in the Bay Area?
I want to. I don't know how to approach doing that yet. Because, you know, in order to viably have your own studio, you need somebody to pay you for your work, or you need to be independently wealthy. One of the two.
Okay.
Yeah, once I get more of these under my belt, it'll be like, I guess the next thing would be to approach like small companies around my area to see if anybody has any need for what I do. Yeah. Especially nowadays, social media posts are huge. I know that there's a market for animators that just do social media posts. And they're really great because they're really quick. They're like 15 to 20 seconds or 15 to 30 seconds, which is awesome.
Yeah. What they are asking for is not, it's different. Different approach.
They're not asking for a feature film. They're asking for like some cute little looping animation.
So you're open for that too.
Oh yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally. But right now my attention is, yeah, I can't throw one more thing in the bucket.
Yeah, okay. Focus on your basketball, this one, and also remember Johnny's sticker someday.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if someone gives you enough money, you can buy a new bucket to put stuff in.
That's true.
Yeah. It's amazing what money will do to a full schedule. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's so right. Anything you want to like promote or shout out, like, besides just how amazing you are?
The only thing I want to shout out is to the supplier that I use to for all of my armature parts. It's a woman that actually lives in like Russia or Eastern Europe or something like that. She has her own eBay store. She's actually a doll maker and model maker, and she sells a lot of these parts. It's the site is called Mooresmore Studio, Moorezmore, and she has a lot of the parts that are hard to find, like these compression plates. You could buy them off of her. And this block over here that's just a square block with threaded holes in them. Threaded ball bearings are incredibly hard to find, and they are incredibly difficult to make yourself. Do not make threaded ball bearings yourself, because it's easier to buy them.
Oh, okay.
And plus,
interesting. I've only seen them on like jewelry, like in like studs and stuff.
Yeah, the first armature that I made with piercing studs.
Yeah.
those ball bearing studs, but she sells these ball bearings in various sizes. I think 6 millimeter, 10 millimeter, 14 millimeter, various sizes. But yeah, and they're cheap. You could buy like 100 of these compression plates for like $30. And that's sort of how I estimated the cost of these armatures. I just breaking down the cost of these armatures. These armatures are roughly about $10 a piece.
Whoa! So
crazy. I mean, I spent about, I would say $50-$60 on the supplies, but $50 to $60 worth of supplies, as long as you have like, you know, other tools with you, like a blowtorch and jewelry solder and flux. If you have those things, $50 of supplies will produce 10 armatures.
Show a disclaimer. Wow. Zaldi will not make you an armature for $6.
No. Yeah.
No, there's labor involved.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that labor involves almost burning yourself. So
every time, like, I won't learn from my lessons. No. Every time.
Yeah, right. Don't touch it when it's hot. Don't touch it when it's hot. If it's even if it doesn't look hot, it's still hot.
I'm guessing this is a permanently burned in memory from doing the soldering on the shoes.
Yeah, and soldering on many other things, but yeah.
That's
like all of these ball, like all of these ball bearings are they're soldered into the stud that they're on. Because I initially tried like gluing them in using like epoxy or Loctite or anything like that, but they've always come off. So I've always like, now I just solder them because I don't need that kind of drama.
Okay. Loctite, if you're so tight, why do you come in different strengths?
Right. Yeah. Right. Because if you've ever had to, there is nothing worse than trying to repair a, to repair a spine ball joint on a puppet that you're in the middle of animating. I've had to do that once. That's not fun.
I can tell in your voice, it's definitely a memory still wakes you up.
Yeah, it does.
Awesome.
Thank you for the shout out. We'd love to share that, right? That website. And we have a question from our previous guest for you. What is that, Johnny?
Who,
oh, okay.
Who you know, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was Nia.
Ah!
But she didn't know it was you, so.
Yeah.
So how is your attitude different from working on a personal project versus a client project? And how do you approach it differently? Which you got into a bit, but I'm curious if you would want anything you'd like to elaborate more on for it.
Mm-hmm.
The attitude with working with it, I think there's a lot more anxiety when it comes to working with a client project, because it's not, you don't fully own it. You don't have full control over it. Mm-hmm. So you have to approach it with a different, with a business, with more of a business mentality, with more of a, you're there to get the job done mentality. They want a certain look, they want a certain direction, and you have to stick with it. There's not a whole lot of deviating. And in a way, it's a lot easier. Just in terms of the mechanicals, it's a lot easier because you're there to get a job done, you do it, and you move on to the next thing. Creatively, it could be, some people may not like it because it's, you're sort of stuck. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're stuck doing it one way. I mean, unless you're a really incredibly seasoned animator with and you've built a relationship with a particular client or a particular studio, that's the only time you could sort of get away with sort of going off the rails a bit. But if you're new to the client or new to the studio, then you sort of have to sort of just approach it with getting the task done.
Yeah. We need your question for next guest as well.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Actually, my question to whoever's next, because I don't know if it's going to be stop motion, CG, or
we don't know, or neither.
Yeah.
But the question is, actually, it's a question that we talked about. How do they approach references?
Okay.
Do they try to copy references, or do they just use the reference as as inspiration? And when they do use references, how much of the references do they copy versus just using as inspiration?
And do they procrastinating?
That's really cool. So there is just one final thing to do then.
Mm-hmm.
Zaldi, end our show.
Ooh, I don't know how to end the show. On the next episode of Nice Shorts, Johnny and Fu may or may not be discussing whether or not mounds are evil or delicious. Stay tuned.